Fred Film Radio, San Sebastian Film Festival, Spain.
Fred Film Radio, I'm David Martos. We're in the 67th edition of San Sebastian Film Festival. I mean, numbers in English are difficult. We're with Roger Mitchell, director of Blackbird. Thank you very much for being with us today. My first question would be, how did you come on board this project?
I was sent a kind of English version of the Danish script. Mm-hmm. I've been careful not to watch the Danish film, which I hear is extremely good. I think was it here at San Sebastian?
Yeah. In competition.
So I was careful to not either consciously or subconsciously sort of contaminate my view of the material by watching the Danish original. But I was sent this original script translated into English, and I thought that I could make something interesting out of it. I was fascinated by the portrait of a family in it as much as by the ethical debate or the kind of the subject matter surrounding euthanasia.
So you haven't seen the film at all now, and you have no intention to do it?
Oh no, I will. Okay. Definitely. Well, when this is all off my chest, I'll look forward to closing the curtains one afternoon and putting it in the machine. Yeah.
Okay, speaking about the ethical debate you mentioned, I was surprised by not hearing the words religion or God in the film. I mean, was that a conscious decision from you, from the script, from the writer, like not having the religion involved in this debate?
I don't think any of the characters in the film believe in God. I think if they did, they would raise that issue. But I don't think they are they're God believers, and I think that's not rare anymore. I don't know. I think that'd be a very interesting film to see someone who is deeply religious contemplating an act of self-harm in this way, because I imagine it's against the rules for lots of religions to kill yourself, whatever the circumstances. It's a crime against God, I believe. Whereas, committing suicide, it isn't a crime against the state. Helping someone else to commit suicide is a more complex area.
What's the state of the debate in the UK now?
I think it's getting more acute. We're having more and more cases where, there was one yesterday, where a woman was being prosecuted for the murder of her husband because she had helped administer a drug to him. She'd then tried to kill herself, but it hadn't worked. So she was then dragged through courts. She was eventually discharged and found not guilty. But it's very complicated, isn't it? People in England have to go to Switzerland normally, to Dignitas, to have this procedure. But if you even book the air ticket for your spouse, you are technically committing a crime. So I think all these, as people live for longer, and old people who are older are more and more active and more independent and more decisive about controlling their own destinies, perhaps. People refusing to kind of go quietly into that good night. People want to take charge of what's going to happen to them. So I think the debate will continue to unfold. I think everyone agrees that good examples of euthanasia, rather like in this film, are in a way unimpeachable. It's the difficult area when it's a relative who no one really wants, or a relative who's very rich, or a relative who has clearly lost their kind of power of coherent thought. How do you legislate around those? How do you protect those people whilst legislating for the rest? So it'll continue to rumble on.
Okay. Speaking about the casting of this film, why did you choose Susan? I mean, I think it strength was needed, fragility too. I mean, it's a combination of both. Why did you choose her?
I think you've answered the question brilliantly.
Thank you.
Yeah. There's this combination of vulnerability and yet wit, humour and strength. And I think she's a very particular skill and a particular she's glorious, she's glamorous, she's not someone who you think is about to die. And I think that's one of the great hinges of the story, is that you know, why don't you, as Mark Twain says, why don't you put off, never put off till tomorrow what you can put off until the day after, mm-hmm. is what Mark Twain said. So why, you know, what brings you to this terrible decision when you could have one more day with your family, one more week, you know, one more month perhaps? So we were very lucky to get Susan.
But one would think she's not the obvious choice. I mean, I don't think she's getting many leading roles in America. Her image connected to her political convictions. Mm. Maybe she doesn't work as much as she deserves.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
And you went on with the decision. I mean, consciously, you decided to cast her in with an artistic.
What, in spite of her political convictions? Do you mean?
No. I don't say these convictions are an obstacle, of course. But I'm talking about her career. I mean, I don't know if you share the perception that she's not getting as many leading roles as she deserves because of that.
I didn't cast her for that reason. Mm-hmm. Certainly not. I cast her because I think she's an outstanding actress. People's careers go in waves of up and down, and you know, I think she's absolutely brilliant and will continue to. She works all the time, Susan.
Mm-hmm. She does.
I think she's at the pinnacle of her career.
Mm-hmm. What about Kate and Mia? Why them for those roles of the two daughters in their family?
Why those particular actors? Well, they're both outstanding actors who are plausible sisters and plausible daughters of Susan, so it was a no-brainer for me. In fact, I brought Kate onto the project first.
Okay.
She was the first person I cast. Yeah, so I built the family in a way around Kate. Okay. Yeah,
that happens in film, right? That one big actor or actress says yes to a project, and then others
it helps
come on board.
It certainly helps if you can say I've got Kate Winslet playing this part. It's a big advert. It's a big excitement for other people. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, really helps.
Speaking about the filmmaking process, which part of this process do you enjoy the most?
The cutting.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because it's quiet, and it's a little room, and it doesn't matter if it rains, and you don't have to look at your watch all the time.
Do you agree with those directors that say that shooting is war?
Shooting, I've heard described in many ways. Somebody once told me it was like pulling furniture out of a burning house. I think that's a pretty good description of it. I mean, this was different. This was a calmer vibe because it was like one location. Everyone was there the whole time. But even so, we had huge challenges because we were shooting in this glass house, you know, and we were shooting at this time of year, a little later actually. So we had to really schedule carefully around light and darkness and dusk and dawn, and because you couldn't there's nowhere to hide in that house, you know, you always saw a window, so you couldn't shoot a day scene at night, although you could plausibly shoot a night scene at day. We didn't do that either. We shot all our night scenes at night so that you could see through the windows.
But speaking of the editing process,
yeah.
Do you think that a director can somehow rewrite the film there?
That the cutting room is where the final rewrite takes place. It's, you always finally do your final rewrite, and you're always surprised by what you learn in the cutting room about your film. So you think your film is one thing on the page, and you hone it, and you shave it, and you sand it, and you polish it, and you're sure that your script is perfect. So you then shoot your script, and you've taken so much care to only shoot the pieces that you really, really need, and then you put the film together in the cutting room and you discover that there are all kinds of things that you don't need. There are all kinds of scenes that you just want to instantly throw over your shoulder. And you sometimes find there's some scenes that you're missing that you either have to pick up or you have to cheat and find a way of inventing those scenes with the material that you've got. So it's an exciting process. And slowly the film takes over. Slowly the film, like Frankenstein, kind of gets up off the table and starts staggering towards you, saying, no, I'm this kind of film, or I'm that kind of film. And you think, oh, okay, sorry, I didn't know that. So that's a very exciting period.
You've been a very successful director in the box office.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've been that.
Not always.
Why would you say you took 5-6 years between your two last movies? What are the reasons? Are they industrial reasons? Are they artistic ones?
What were my last two movies? What were they?
I mean, this one and The Weeknd. I mean, these two last films.
I think I've done quite a lot since then. Maybe I did a TV thing that was quite successful, and I still do plays.
Yeah, but I'm asking this because some directors say, despite a previous success in the box office,
I've made another film since then. No. I did My Cousin Rachel since then as well. So I've been churning them out, actually.
Really?
Yeah. My Cousin Rachel wasn't here, but it was... Did you see that with Rachel Weisz?
I don't think so, but...
Yeah. So I don't think there has been that scary gap that you've just mentioned.
So you don't find any difficulties to... raise money for your projects when you want to do it.
It's always difficult to make films. Okay. It's always been difficult. Yeah.
Where are the difficulties for you when you find them?
Do you mean raising the money? I mean, or do you mean
building up a project?
It depends what the budget level is. You know, it depends if it's like if it's a tiny film like The Weeknd, it's pretty easy to raise. I think that we made that for like 3 million or something like that. This film was easy to make because the studio paid for everything. Millennium wonderfully picked up the check for the whole film. So it's when you can make the film for one organisation, like the next film I'm making is for Pathé. So that's always glorious. When you have to make up the funding with a little bit from here and a little bit from there and a bit from a fund and a bit from the BFI, and when you have to glue all those pieces together, that's when it becomes really difficult, because they all want they're vying with each other. You know, the funders are all vying with each other for their piece of the back end, so making that machine all kind of all the cogs go in the right direction is sometimes frustrating.
We just went to Venice, to the Venice Film Festival, and the big debate there was the separation or not between a director and his work, speaking about Polanski, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Do you think that a director should be separated from his work, his private life in one side and his work in the other one?
Do you mean because of
the
criminal behavior?
Private life?
Yeah. I don't think that should just apply to film directors. I think that applies to anybody who has... you know, who has broken laws. It shouldn't be particular to show business.
So you think that a director with this kind of past should be still selected for competing in a big festival like Venice or San Sebastian?
I think it's difficult. I think in Polanski's case it is difficult, because he, unlike Woody Allen, Polanski was found guilty of quite a serious crime. I know there were all kinds of complexities surrounding the way he left America, but I think it's difficult. I think it's a very difficult situation. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think Woody Allen is different though, because
totally, yeah.
Woody Allen is someone who, as far as I know, has never been found guilty of any offence whatsoever, as far as I know,
mm-hmm.
And I think that if you believe in the idea that you're innocent until proved guilty, then people who have deserted Woody Allen, I think some people are starting to swim back towards Woody Allen, but again, it's a very difficult case.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned TV earlier. What do you think about the audiovisual landscape? It has changed in the last 5 years, with Netflix showing up and HBO producing more and et cetera. How do you think this changes dramatically the landscape?
Well, it obviously changes the structure of fiction, doesn't it? Because these long-form TV shows have a kind of ability to behave more like novels than plays. Films are still really based on three-act structure via Aristotle, whereas Netflix or other streaming services can do much more digressive, much more unstructured and interesting work, rather like, you know, Dickens novels versus a short story. So I think that's all for the good, and I think it's a new form which is having its glory days right now, and I think it's quite hard for the industry in places like the UK, where the various studios around London are just being picked off by these massive multinational companies, so that Warner's have taken over Leavesden, Pinewood, Netflix are going to take over Pinewood, so that these mega beasts are coming and sort of landing on our tiny little industry and sucking out all our skill bases are all rushing off towards, you know, Netflix. I'm prepping a film at the moment, and lots of people are off doing 20 weeks on a Netflix series for twice the money we can offer them. So that's going to be an interesting battle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Roger Mitchell, director of Blackbird.
Michel.
Yeah, because there's no T there.
There's no T.
People are always mistaking that. Okay. Sorry. Roger Mitchell, director of Blackbird here in San Sebastian. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
This was an interview for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.